when I first started my academic career, I was a freshman in animal science at Texas Tech in 2009, and I ended up being on a meats judging team the next year. And I remember at that time, like anything over 950, that was a discount. And it's progressively changed over time. They've added 50 pounds, 50 pounds, 50 pounds. And now there's some grids that allow cattle up to 1,150 pounds, which is rough, quick math in my head. That's about 1,750 to 1,800 pound live weight. And so this trend has really been occurring, AJ, like you said, since 1960. Like there, if you had to bet or say carcass weights are at their cap, you wouldn't bet against this line. Like the Vegas odds would be 100%. It's 5 pounds a year. It's so freaking straight.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Give your cattle platinum protection with Virbac Bovagen Platinum Vaccines. Start your protection at us.virbac.com/platinum protection. Data shows most cattle don't get enough vitamin D, which can impact health and performance. High D from DSM Firmenich can help improve cattle's vitamin D status. Be proactive with Cattle Active. Visit ProEarthAnimalHealth.com today. Lalamond Animal Nutrition offers microbial solutions to boost animal welfare and performance.
Welcome to the Beef Podcast Show. I am Dr. AJ Tarpoff, and today on the Beef Podcast Show, we're going to be bringing the dedicated insights of discussions from the top minds of our industry, and today is no exception. We have a wonderful guest today. Really excited to have a nice in-depth conversation about this topic, but I want to first introduce somebody that is not new to this podcast platform, Dr. Zach Smith from South Dakota State University. Brief information about Dr. Smith: received his bachelor degree in animal science from Texas Tech, his master's from South Dakota State University in 2015, followed by his PhD degree in 2018, again from Texas Tech University. Zach and his team conduct applied research focused on nutrition and management interventions that enhance receiving, growing, and finishing beef lot beef and beef-derived livestock production up at SDSU. Zach and his wife and his two children reside near Brookings. And with that, Zach, welcome to the Beef Podcast Show.
I'm excited to be back. The Canadian wildfires and corn pollen have got everybody's sinuses messed up. So I feel like I've been sick every time I've been on this podcast. I need to get my health up a little bit. But I'm excited to be here, and I'll try to speak loudly.
Okay, so today we have a really interesting topic. This is top of mind with a lot of people within the industry. But what we're going to chat about today is hot carcass weight and the trends that have been increasing since really from 1960 to today.
Yeah, forever.
So I'd like to set that as kind of the stage of we're going to talk about these bigger and heavier weight cattle. So Zach, with that, how do we do this? What is the history of increasing hot carcass weight, and how do we get there? How do we manage these animals?
Man, this is such an interesting topic. When I first started my academic career, I was a freshman in animal science at Texas Tech in 2009, and I ended up being on a meats judging team the next year. And I remember at that time, like anything over 950, that was a discount. And it's progressively changed over time. They've added 50 pounds, 50 pounds, 50 pounds. And now there's some grids that allow cattle up to 1,150 pounds, which is rough, quick math in my head. That's about 1,750 to 1,800 pound live weight. And so this trend has really been occurring, AJ, like you said, since 1960. Like there, if you had to bet or say carcass weights are at their cap, you wouldn't bet against this line. Like the Vegas odds would be 100%. It's 5 pounds a year. It's so freaking straight. And the one interesting thing about this too is that we do it at a younger age than previously. We finish cattle. A lot of times, most of them are harvested by 18 to 24 months of age. And we've done this all too while keeping kind of what I would say is weaning calf weights have kind of remained or at least plateaued since the early 80s. They haven't increased much, but it's the back end management. It's growing cattle instead of pushing them as calves. It's using the right steroidal implants at the right phase of production that matches the nutrient supply to those critters. And then it's beta agonists and good feed management and genetics. It's all of the above, really. And we're lucky enough now to kind of have all of that come together, and we're going to keep increasing. I got a picture I got for a wedding one time. It was a wedding gift from some of my beef cattle colleagues, and it was called the Back Alley Crowd. It was a Ken Wyatt art, Western artwork. And this pen of cattle had 20 different colors in it, and different sizes and shapes. They all went to market at the same time. Well, today we market cattle in more homogenous groups, right? Maybe it's all black-hided or char crosses, and we're able to target their endpoint. And I think also just selling them in the beef has become different too. I remember even early on in my grad career, a 1,600-pound steer got turned around at Tyson. We'd sell them at regional, and they'd go into a kosher kill facility, and they'd top the market. I'll say one last thing. I know I'm talking a lot, but I recall when Dr. Pritchard started working here in the early 80s, he told me what carcass weights were. And they were just a nickel over 650, 700. This was right around low, high sevens, mid sevens. And since between that time, or let's just say it was 650 and the time he left, when average carcass weight was about 950. And that's kind of, we're somewhere in that neighborhood now. That was within the past 5 years. I'd say the upper end's gone up. Each cow in the pasture has produced 50% more beef than she did when he started. And I used to kick myself around, be like, there's no way we're going to do that in my career. But I've got to pull those blinders off. We actually might. If we keep on, I didn't know about this bedding line we talked about, but it's going up. And so I think that for a lot of young animal scientists, this is like new problems for us to help solve. Like, what's the impact of a 1,800-pound steer on his 24 months of age? He's carrying around the same weight as a mature bull that does it at, you know, 5 or 6 years of age. There's tons of issues and things we can get into that really make me excited.
Zach, let's dive into a little bit of that, because I think you hit the nail on the head. We have genetics, we have management, we have different tools and technologies that have led us down this path. But let's look at that 1,800-pound steer at 24 months of age. How do we do that today? You know, you mentioned some of the economic drivers that's pushing to this heavier weight. Give a little bit of background scenario on how we got here, even within the last 2 years.
Yeah, I would say, and it's really taken off in the last 2 years. One thing I will say is, cattle supply too dictates this, right? So we have, the beef industry is really smart. I read this somewhere the other day. Less is more for beef cattle producers, in the sense that fewer feeder cattle, we can feed them to heavier weights, we've got cheap corn. We are in the driver's seat now. We're in the cattle business, and this is really important. And we're able to still keep beef on shelves by, you know, just changing our outweight. I sent a group of cattle to harvest earlier this year. Best winter feeding weather we'd ever had in South Dakota. We fed them from October, first week of October to March. And when they left the facility, I actually couldn't weigh them all. They were getting stuck in our cattle processing shed. All right. And this is not a new, it's not an old shed. It literally were too big. And when I got the packer report back, I was like, whoa, this is nice. Well, then I got a text from the cattle buyer and said, did you see how they did? And I was like, well, they graded like 30% prime, 70% fours and fives. And you'd think that like is scary. So then that makes me question, maybe they get more meat out of them than we think. One time I hit up Dr. Preston, and he had fed some Charolais crosses in the late 70s, Rod Preston. He was Pritchard's postdoc advisor, really involved from DES all the way to Revlor implants. And he was retired and at his home in Bellingham, Washington, when I emailed him. And he's like, Zach, why did I have yield grade sixes? And I came up with this complex reason why. And he's like, well, it could just be that carcass weights were so high, and that makes it a crash. So I think we get a lot more red meat yield out of these critters than what we see maybe when we do yield grade and stuff. But at least here recently, it's simply a fact of, I think part of it is lots aren't as full as they've been. And the replacement cost of the next critter is more than it costs to buy the last one. And so we want to dilute out that initial purchase cost on the one we have and maximize his revenue. Those cattle that I took to 1750 that couldn't fit through our processing shed that worked every other year, those cattle, they graded really nicely. They got really big. They were really efficient, and they just kept eating, and we kept pouring the coals to them. And so a variety of things. I think packer acceptance of these larger cattle. When we feed a whole population of cattle past the old target was 4/10. I hear a lot of discussion about making cattle grade prime at 4/10. Yeah, those cattle exist. And when there's a lot of cattle in the supply chain, those are good cattle. We don't have to feed them longer. But when we have fewer cows in the pastures making beef destined progeny, a prime 4/10 of an inch, 800 pound carcass isn't going to cut it. We still need to feed them to have 1,000 pound carcasses to support domestic beef demand. But nice fellow Pete Anderson told me one time, was in a lecture class when I was a student. He said, if you had to make so many units per year, all right, we got 25 million units a year. Do you want to make Ford Pintos or Ford Excursions? We want to make Ford Excursions, and we do it better than anybody in the world. Everybody else is just trying to play catch up with that.
You know, I do have a question pertaining to these heavy carcasses. We're feeding them. You know, you mentioned a couple different things. One, you can keep feeding them. The efficiency, the market, the everything is running that direction. And I agree with you 100%. Now, to play the opposite here, what's going to stall this out? What's going to stall this trajectory? You mentioned a couple things. Size. You know, they couldn't fit through your facility. Do these animals still fit on our transportation trailers? Do they still fit in the slaughter facility? Do they, you know, when we send them to a packer, you know, what's going to max us out? Is it physiology? Or can we not feed these bigger? Or is it infrastructure?
Infrastructure, both. And one's probably easier to fix than the other. Well, maybe not. So infrastructure wise, I can remember back, you were probably in grad school, AJ, there was this Dr. Thompson and Chris, Dr. Reinhardt, they were going around and doing a transportation type audit. And all the, it wasn't the horns, it was the cattle going into the bottom of the trailer. They bruised their backs. I think there's been some modifications on the newer trailers they build here in South Dakota, like the Wilson trailers, to help mitigate some of those issues of cattle, you know, bruising their top line. You know, a lot of the new plants have retooled recently, and they have new, a lot of those old harvest floors were built in the late 60s, early 70s into the 80s. And those were designed, yeah, for cattle of that time. I can recall the 60-inch rule when that came out. I was in grad school. That would specifically pertain to the dairy beef, the purebred dairies. And what it was is they were having to put rubber bands around their mouths so their tongues didn't drag on the floor, and they just got tired of dealing with it. There were other things, but those plants weren't designed to have cattle that drug the ground. Most of the new modern beef facilities, the newer ones they're building, all of the stuff is in the air. They're all working on platforms. So I don't think from the getting them harvested is a problem, but they didn't update the coolers or the blast chillers. Those still are all 1960s lumber and steel. What about the refrigeration system? Can they get those cattle cooled off in a timely, because it's surface area to mass? Like, these are things well beyond my understanding as an animal scientist. But there's a lot of opportunities to figure these things out. From a physiology perspective, there's a new data set out of WT that the gal just had her thesis defense. I saw her presentation at ASAS in Hollywood, and it was talking about just the size of organs, like the heart, the lungs, and those don't grow in proportion to body weight. Now, the one thing that I think that we should look at in those data is actually – the weight of those organs relative to the fat-free body mass. When you just look at weight, yeah, it's going out. But if we pull all the fat out, but still the fat has vascularization and all these things. Maybe if we look at it on a protein tissue basis to these important metabolic organs, maybe it's not as bad. I don't really know where that falls apart. But one thing I know you're probably tuned into way better than me, but I experienced this last week, is so much of what I recall in college and in graduate school there were symposiums on it, was early calf weaning calf or receiving cattle health. We haven't pulled a calf in a long time at the research feedlot in the first 60 days. Where we have problems now is on the back end with feet and digestive issues, late-term deads. Like, I was, you know, it was always bad to lose a calf, but losing a calf the day after you bought them was not as bad as losing a calf that's worth $3,800 last week, 2 weeks out from selling them. I wish I could have found this critter earlier and done something different with them, but I think as we move forward, this late-term mortality is going to be a big focus as we had on BRD maybe in the early days, because it just hurts so much more to lose that critter. Not when he's $600. That's what the problem was back in the day. Now he's worth $4,000. And now everybody in this pen is losing $40 to $20 a head. It's like, whoa, it's a problem.
Well, I think that provides the incentive for the industry, right? Just looking at the cost difference of what we were battling 20 years ago to today, it's a different population. We're feeding them for longer days. We've solved a lot of things. We've gotten better at a lot of things. But you just pointed out there's still things that we need to accomplish as an industry to kind of keep rolling.
Yeah, and the epidemiologists, I like the way they look at it. It's just even the more days they spend around instead of 100 days, now they're here for 250 days, there's 150 more days or opportunities for something to go wrong. And then the critter can perish. So it's really cool. It's actually a very exciting time to be involved in the beef cattle production business.
Well, it is exciting. What's also exciting is the flip side, the consumer. I truly believe now is one of the best opportunities for as a consumer to buy beef. And, we've got heavier carcasses. Does that impact our consumer?
You know, I think when I think about this it's been crazy post COVID, it used to be people ate beef, they eat chicken and pork at home. They'd eat beef. No one, but I don't think a lot of people thought that they could grill a steak as good as a prime steakhouse at home. And something happened. People figured out how to cook and grill beef. People eat a lot of beef at home now. I got colleagues here in South Dakota. They've never bought beef at a grocery store. They've always grown it themselves and had it harvested. That's changed. A lot of people, they like to put up a freezer of beef, and they figured out how to cook all these different cuts, which I think at the same time, when you only get middle meats, you're comfortable cooking them. But when you figure out how to use the whole quarter of beef you bought, now all of a sudden you start to buy new and exciting cuts at the grocery store that used to just be we wanted tenderloins and ribeyes. That's helped a lot too. Carnivore diet, that's like a real thing, and people are obsessed with beef and eating fat. Those things have all changed. I think one thing that, at least for my family, when we eat beef, we don't eat it like we do when we go out to eat. When you go to Texas Roadhouse, you get your 8 to 10 ounce ribeye, you eat the whole thing. And in our house, when I go and buy two ribeyes from Walmart, every consumer, 90% of the U.S. population I read is within 10 miles of a Walmart. And Walmart's got really good beef. And there's other good beef at other places, but this is my local grocery store. That's where I go buy beef. I can go get a prime ribeye. It's $20 a pound. So for $40, I get two big steaks. And that one ribeye will feed my, and I'm sure this won't work forever. I got an 8.5-year-old and a 3.5-year-old. They're going to be wanting their own steak soon. But I can slice that up. They don't know about the spinalis yet, so I'll eat that. And then they get the middle piece, and that goes three ways. It feeds my wife, my two sons. And so now all of a sudden we've got a $20 piece of meat that goes four ways, and we pair it with a single ingredient item like corn on the cob, watermelon, sliced cucumbers. And we've got $4 in protein per person, and then the associated sides. It's still cheaper than going to fast food. It takes a little bit of planning, but I feel so much better when I eat like that than going and getting chicken tenders that are deep fat fried and then cold French fries by the time I get home. I'd much rather eat the ribeye with the easy to cook side that it pairs nicely with. And that's literally what we eat all summer is picanha, ribeye, corn on the cob, tomatoes, and cucumbers. It's the best living ever. And then in the winter, we eat McDonald's, which is fine too, because I love McDonald's.
Well, and I don't think you're alone. And I think some consumer preferences have changed that have really allowed us to go down this path. You mentioned pulling the spinalis off. I've seen restaurants in different places that just offer a ribeye roll, you know, just the inside of the ribeye. And a lot of our consumer preference, they enjoy it. They accept it.
Yeah, the consumer's got to get used to it. I recall my dad was at Sysco Foods, and Paul Heinrich was a Texas Tech Meats judge, did all the protein purchasing for Sysco. The most popular cuts they ever brought on was the flat iron. And originally they were like, this is not, nobody's going to eat this. Well, it put beef at a price point that people could afford, and they liked it. And now it's like a very popular cut. Do you know the most valuable cut on a beef carcass per pound? People think tenderloin. I think it's the skirt steak. There's only two of them. And this time of year, everybody wants fajitas. It's interesting how that whole cutout deal works too.
Well, the cutout's really important just to be able to pull a profit. And, you know, hats off. There's been so much research going into consumer preference and getting the highest value that we can out of each cut of beef that matches what that consumer really wants. Now, hitting that consumer preference, you already talked about prime. Prime's a whole other topic that we can briefly touch on that. Prime has exploded in the industry, partly maybe due to heavier carcasses, but talk a little bit about where our industry has gone with, you know, prime carcasses.
So it's definitely delineated by probably south of Kansas, north of Kansas type deal, cattle down in the southern plains. Let's just say when I started college, that was 60 to 70% choice. They're probably rolling 75, 85, 90. North of here, it's probably 90% choice. Northern Plains production is probably 85, 90% choice routinely. What we do see as the industry as a whole, and my numbers are probably a little off, was maybe and I should look at the most recent beef quality audit. It just came out in TAS like a few weeks back. But I think I saw somewhere around 8.5, 9, 10% prime. That's everywhere. That used to be the target up here. And in Texas, maybe it wasn't unheard of, but it was sub for 5% for sure. There were pockets of cattle that could do it. But now there's loads of cattle that go 30, 45, 50% prime in my neck of the woods. I think a lot of that is genetics. A lot of it is management. We're not using the wrong tools at the wrong time. If cattle have the genetics to do it and we let them express themselves, the only thing you and I can do is screw it up. They'll be able to do it. But as a whole, prime is the new target. Depending upon where you're at in the country, it's got a really nice premium per hundredweight. From a consumer experience, when we get to those upper two-thirds in prime grades, and I would say the average consumer can tell a difference between average choice and prime. The real thing is that it's really hard to screw those steaks up when you overcook them. They're still tasty even if you cook them to shoe leather consistency. You do that to a select steak, you're going to go back and buy pork the next time you're at the grocery store because you screw it up if you cook it too much. And so it's a cushion for bad cooking, non-trained cook staffs. It tastes good. You get that explosion in your mouth. But prime for us, and I'm sure there's a lot to it, that's our target, right? We want to see, and I don't see it in certain populations of cattle I feed just based upon their genetics, but they still grade 90, 95% choice. They just have no ability to reach the prime grade. There are cattle out there that can do it. And when you get them, you want to manage those to maximize that. Now, one thing we probably do when we feed this group of cattle to 1,800 pounds is we do get hit with the discounts. The fours and fives hit. The heavy carcass weight discounts, they hit. The prime hits too. And they like that. At any rate, all of the carcass premiums you get on that grid, depending upon where you're selling, they all disappear. But what you end up generating is 150 pounds more carcass weight at 350 plus a pound or 375 on a carcass weight basis. That's a lot more money in your pocket. And I actually pulled up some cheat sheets. We did a study with North American Limousine Foundation. And we actually fed these cattle to 348 days post-weaning. And what we saw, they all spent either, we backgrounded them for 78 days, and then we fed them for 235 or 270 in the feedlot on a finishing diet. And what we saw by extending the feeding period from 200 to 270 days was a profit per head. And this was just using a standard grid for all these. They sold at different times of the year. First kill group, $284. The last kill group, $417. And so we added $130 by feeding them an extra 70 days. And then it comes into some income over feed costs. But, well, no, this was profit. This is actually the profit slide I have pulled up. So the economics say keep going, keep going, keep going. I don't know why you'd stop. You'd have to have a good reason to want to stop right now. And nobody's telling us otherwise.
Is there, as a cattle feeder, and you mentioned that population animals that you're expecting to feed to prime or get a, you know, that have that genetic potential to hit prime. How do you manage those differently than you would just another high performing animal that is still going to feed to 1800 pounds? What about that prime? Do you manage those any different?
The last group we sent out that did hit 30% prime, they got the same amount of implants at the right time. We used every technology available to man except, you know, terminal sorting, because in the research setting, we don't send them out. We send the whole group at once. Now, those cattle had implants and beta agonists. Like I said, you can screw it up if you do it at the wrong time. But we know now how to use those tools. You don't give a calf off grass. Well, you can. These things eat quite a bit. These are all grass cattle. They come in, eat, weighing 900 or 1,000 pounds, green as a gourd. They still have had adequate nutrition to support the stromal cells and marbling development. They weren't screwed up. They'll eat 2% of their body weight the first day. You might wait to implant them. You don't have to. We typically wait 21 to 28 days to implant all cattle. That doesn't work for everybody, but we don't really implant newly arrived cattle. Those types of strategies really help. And given the new rules on delayed implantation, it actually works out great. We can have effective coverage all the way through. We need to figure out the timing of that implant. But yeah, don't give them an implant when they just get off the truck. Okay, that fits a lot of operations. That's just the work they want to do. But it isn't a way to maximize genetic potential for grade. Using a beta agonist can hurt. The ones we've been using lately don't seem to hurt marbling nearly as bad as some of the other ones that we've had previously. So, and really a lot of the early effects on marbling was actually just a dilution of intermuscular adipose tissue because the muscles got bigger. But now we've used all the technology on cattle that has been available to producers in our last 3 years. We've always used implants. We've gotten back into using the new beta agonist available, and things are still getting better. We are feeding them longer, but we use all the technology in the world, man, that is available.
What you're saying is when we have tools, we use them appropriately, and we have positive outcomes.
Yeah, you just got to use them. You don't, you know, nothing to pick on a veterinarian, AJ, but one time we got a call from a stakeholder who had given some grass calves a Rev 200 because it was a 200-day implant. That was a veterinarian recommendation. It was insane. And they had riders and bullets. I know you wouldn't do that, but there are people out there doing it. You need to talk to an expert, whether that's your pharma salesperson or the university. Most people at universities on the beef nutrition side, they can help provide you guidance on these things to not screw things up. But yeah, it can happen. Bad advice can be really hurtful.
All right. Well, I've got one other question pertaining to this space, and it has to do with, you know, we've got beef demand that has stayed extremely high, right? This is the highest we've ever had beef demand. We have record prices, right, that have happened at the same time, which never happens. How do we answer the call to our consumer to let them know that it's okay to spend this extra money on this superior product? How long can we continue this trend?
Well, I think a lot of things we need to think about is that U.S. beef production domestically, we're actually in a global business. All right. We make a lot of good, high quality middle cuts. Reason we can still have people price point in ground beef at the grocery store is, did you know we have record beef imports today? and the highest beef prices ever, it does not go with what everybody wants to talk about on social media. But we need to support that because we're making all this high quality beef that isn't for everybody. And we're bringing in this lean trim to help support our high quality beef production. All right. That keeps beef in everybody's diet, which is what we should want as an industry. We want everybody picking beef over the other proteins. The other deal is that I just think we've had a lightning fire in their consumers, and they want to eat prime and upper choice ribeyes. I think as we move the future forward, it's going to be, when I was in school, it was about fitting the cut size to the plate. Now it's the table. I want to go eat like Salt Bay style steak where they drop the Maldon salt on it and everybody just grabs their favorite piece of the ribeye. I think we're very fortunate in the U.S. to have really the most dynamic beef production system. Like, we're not probably the best in the world at we're good. You know, you go to New Zealand, they're very extensive based. It's grazing and paddocks and different types of moving cattle around pastures. But from intensive beef production, we do the best job in the world. And this has provided opportunities. You know, for every $1 spent in beef cattle production, there's about $2.50 to $3 of local economic impact. Spent. When you get a dollar, you go spend $3 at the Dollar General. That's pretty much what they're saying. And just farm door receipts in beef cattle production is $2 to $3 billion annually. If you multiply that by $3, it's nearly $1 trillion in economic impact by beef production. And that's why in South Dakota, I live in a state where our primary export in beef cattle is feeder calves, and they're the best feeder calves in the world. And they go down to Southwest Kansas, and I'd love for them to all stay here, but they don't all. And so my goal is to figure out how to get more small to medium sized producers in our region to retain this high value product in South Dakota so that we can have the benefit of the corn truck, the co-product truck, the guy deliver them. All that money stays in South Dakota.
I agree with you 100%. Beef is king, right? That's what producers spend more money on that high quality product today than they ever have before. And I think the trend's going to go. It's going to continue.
Well, I bought some bone on, like, Walmart has these boneless, skinless chicken thighs, and they're flash frozen. They're simple because I can throw them in a cold water bath and get them ready to cook. But I like chicken skin. So I bought some chicken thighs. My wife likes breasts, but you cannot do enough to a breast, really, other than like shred it and add mayo and make chicken salad, you know. And I do like rotisserie chickens at Walmart. I haven't fallen beside on those, but I bought some chicken thighs with bone in, skin on, and I bought 5 pounds for $6. And I bought those 3 weeks ago, and I've still got more than half of them left, and I've bought beef 4 times since then. So at least you know where my mind's at. I'd rather eat beef. And I think consumers, you know, pork, they got bacon. Nobody really likes a pork chop that much unless it's like a Berkshire pork chop that's got a lot of marbling in it. And I feel bad. I work with a lot of great pork producers, but beef is king. It is a protein choice most people want on their plate. I think when people buy it and cook it, it'd be like lobster in the 80s. It's an affluent thing, too. You feel we have more money to spend on these types of things, and we want to have the best tasting product to feed our family. And beef fits the bill on so many levels. It's a versatile thing. You can cook it. You can fry it. The state dish of South Dakota is fried sirloin. It's called chislik. We call them beef tips in other parts of the world or something. But it's a versatile ingredient. It tastes good. And it really is, when you look at it on a serving basis, it's a pretty cost-effective protein. I mean, it might be 3 or 4 times the cost of pork, but it tastes good. And that's what people remember. They don't remember what's it like. Dave Ramsey would be like, you can't take your IRA to retirement. Buy the jet boat or something.
Buy the prime ribeye.
Buy the prime ribeye. That's right.
It's time for our famous three.
Is stress affecting your bottom line? Even routine handling, inclement weather, weaning, and dietary changes can significantly lower the rumen pH, causing cortisol levels to spike. Cortisol not only compromises the immune system, but also suppresses normal appetite and feed consumption. The solution? Cattle Active. Increase production and reduce the impacts of stress on your cattle for cents a day. Cattle Active restores the balance naturally. Want to learn more how a feeding program, including Cattle Active, can improve both profits and herd health? Visit us today at proearthanimalhealth.com. Be proactive with Cattle Active.
This has been a fun conversation, and I want to wrap up with kind of the traditional beef podcast show three questions. And we talked a little bit about it before the show, but I do want to wrap up with, what is your favorite beef cattle production resource? What is your go-to that you want to recommend for folks?
Yeah, I would say, and I've had this question, this is probably the third time I've answered this on this podcast, and they're going to be like, this guy's a rubberneck because he changes. Well, there's always something new to read. I think in 2025, for anybody, you don't have to be an academician, a technical consultant, a private consultant, any of that. This information that we use is available at everybody's fingertips. It's all open access, right? It used to be behind paywalls. There are tons of things. For the average consumer, learning to use things like artificial intelligence and asking prompts, those tools are at your fingertips today. I asked AI to help build a diet with like six ingredients, and it wasn't far off on what I would have done, which is frightening, which I think changes the landscape in the future. What I've been working on now, reading wise, this is kind of new. There's a paper published in Ruminants. This is an MDPI journal. It's called Knowledge Gaps in the Nutrient Requirements of Beef Cattle. And it's got a table at the very end with knowledge gaps and research needs. And it's got things on energy, carbs, lipids, proteins, minerals and vitamins, feed intake, maintenance, growth, reproduction, stress and disease, environmental issues, feed compositions and models. And this really for me is going to be a kind of a, it's not a seminal text yet, but it's a driving force or guide that I'm going to use for our research program here in the next 4 or 5 years of seeing what knowledge gaps exist. You know, anytime I do a project, we end up with 10 new questions. Like you do the project and you create 20 new research ideas, and there's never the correct amount of funding to do all this. So you got to pinpoint and decide where you're best off. But this has been a good read. Send it to all my graduate students, anybody associated with me. They got the email. I think I found it one night when I was supposed to be sleeping. I was scrolling through and I found this paper and I texted it to the postdoc. And the next morning he was in my office reading it. All the NASEM publications, those are seminal texts. They're free. Most of them have digital copies. I don't even think you have to pay for them anymore. But really just there is a lot of good information out there, and it might be sitting right underneath your nose. You just got to go look for it. And AI is helpful for the average person to go and dig. We get access to libraries and all those things at the academic institutions. But there's a lot of info out there. I prefer to read something nice and easy, like journal articles. I'm not much of a novel reader.
No, that's fair.
Selfless plug, AJ and I wrote a book chapter on environmental stressors. That should be coming out shortly. That's the best beef resource on the market now. No.
I appreciate the plug, but I think the resource, you're spot on. Two, you already gave us was going to be my second question, but you already filled that in on what you're reading right now. It's good to always challenge ourselves. I agree.
I actually did pick up a novel this week. Like, I haven't read a chapter book, except I read a book with my son for the all school read, and I was buying vegetables at the farmer's market, which I like buying those local. My garden didn't turn out this year, so I'm at the farmer's market. I'm buying tomatoes, and I start talking to this guy. He's from Iroquois, South Dakota. I was like, do you know Warren Rushi? He said, yeah. He's kind of my neighbor. And this is already after I'd checked out. My touch to pay didn't work. He punched it in, put in the wrong ID code. It got declined, so I used another car because he put in the wrong code. And he's like, after I paid out, he's like, actually, I have a book. I was like, oh, I'll take it. He's like, it's $15. I was like, all right, I got to pay you again. But Warren's wife did the artwork, and it was like a diary of a post-World War II in DeSmet, South Dakota. And I picked it up, and I read the whole thing this weekend, and it was kind of cool. It was a simple life back then. It was really cool. So if anyone's looking for a good book to read, it's called The Passable Cook by J.W. Jesser. Anybody would enjoy it, especially if you're a Midwesterner, your folks homesteaded or lived on a relinquishment. It's really neat. This is a good book.
That's cool. That's a good book, and it sounds like it was entertaining if you read it through in a weekend.
I read it in the whole weekend, man. My kids were like, what are you doing, Dad? I'm reading a book.
Hey, let's finish on this. And I think this is important going forward, just as an industry and you and I as educators. What makes a great leader in our industry?
I got something up here on my wall. It says advice for research group leaders. It says be a good mentor and communicate readily with everyone. I don't know all these by heart, so I'm going to read them. Provide guidance and standards for data management. You got to set timelines and make sure people meet them. You need to review raw data. That's what I do. I love data crunching. You got to set good examples. The one other thing that these are three pieces of advice I give to everyone, man, and I'm lucky. I had good friends in college. I liken that to the judging program. I got involved immediately when I got to college. It kept me out of a lot of trouble in Lubbock, Texas, because that is a place you can really screw things up in. It's great, great school. Send your kids there or to South Dakota. But you can get in trouble there if you don't have the right friend group. So I always tell people you got to surround yourself with good friends. You need to talk to your family. Call your mom and dad if you still can. I was born after my folks were 40. They're in their mid-70s now, but talk to them daily. Always go to class, or if you're in work, you want to be the first one there and the last one to leave. That's kind of hardcore. That was kind of where I was brought up in is you work harder than everybody else by being there longer. I think now I'm learning students work differently and can get different things done if you suit their environment to their learning style, right? So I used to be show up at 8, leave at 5. Well, now I understand that some kids like to – they start their morning off at home, and they come in at 10, and they work till 7. It's – so I've had to change the way I see things to a new model of students. I guess you just got to be adaptable and ready for change. The one last thing that I tell all the students when they get here is that Malcolm Gladwell had this deal in his book, The Outliers, said something about the 10,000-hour rule. That's just the dues you got to pay to become the expert. And then after that, you're not done learning, but the 10,000 hours gets you the PhD, roughly. That's about 5 years of 5 hours a day of dinking around every day of the week, I think. I did the math once. It's a lot of time, but that's literally just gets you the credentials and then never stop learning. There's things that I need to learn today that I've always kind of protected myself. I stay away from things that I don't play golf or tennis because I suck at it, but maybe I'd have fun if I did it. So there's things I need to learn to this day. Always be a learner and willing to listen, to work with smarter people too. That's the key. You want to work with people and have people work under you that are 20 times better than you. Cause I can tell you for a fact today, dude, there's no way I'd make it through. The kids we get today, dude, they're way brighter than I was. I look like a dummy compared to them, but they make you look good. So you get the right team and let their strengths build and rise the whole ship. It's not about one person. It's about the whole team and good friends.
And good friends. And it's been a pleasure to actually be on here with a good friend and a colleague. And I tell you, the future is bright. I've met several of your graduate students at various events, and the future is bright regardless where you are in the cattle industry. We have a lot of great people. We're gonna leave the cattle industry in good hands by the time we're done.
Yeah, we're lucky, and I was lucky. And I told my kids, it's not about what you know. It's about the people you know and the relationships you build, because the beef industry really is 2 to 3 degrees of separation and everybody knows you. So be nice, kind to others, you know, control your emotions and those things. Just being a good colleague and friend and trustworthy will get you way farther than the amount of stuff you can recite off the top of your head. Because by the end of this, literally AI might take all the knowledge base and it's there. And then you just got to lead them to it. So it's not about what you know. It's about the people you know and the relationships you build. That's this business, which is awesome. It's an awesome business to be in.
Well, with that, I can guarantee to our listeners, this was not AI generated.
No.
As you can tell from this conversation. So,
no, we would have confused the model.
Well, folks listening in, I hope you really enjoyed this show. Like, comment, share this to all your friends. I hope you've enlightened yourself on some of the up and coming things happening with the industry. Just like Dr. Smith talked about, continuous learning, continuous improvement. We're always trying to do better. So that concludes this episode of the Beef Podcast Show. I'm Dr. AJ Tarpoff, and my host today was Dr. Zach Smith from South Dakota State University. And thank you for being with us today.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent without a time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on more $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.